Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. On today's episode, I speak with Dr. Daniel Foer. He is a psychologist who's bridging the gap between animism and conventional psychology.
It's also a way of chipping at the extreme individualism that therapy can often unintentionally recreate. It's like, here are my problems. I'm going to come pay you to help me with my problems. Well, if we address the colonialism and the sexism and the racism and the classism and the bigotry and supremacy, what problems do you have left? What if all of your problems are systemic?
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I am your host, Luis Mojica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music, and then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. I work with Irka Mateo, who's an indigenous Taino elder, and she's my guide. I work with her every month, and I've had her on the show. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Amber McZeal, who is a psychologist and the amazing woman who comes on to talk about decolonizing the psyche, which is her work. Both of these women have told me about Dr. Foer, and I respect them both so much. I thought, okay, I'll look into his work. So I went on his website and I took his animism psychology course. And it's absolutely fantastic because those of you listening to this who are witches, who are indigenous, who work with your indigenous roots, who are earth-based, who are metaphysical, who are spiritual, And you know that feeling when you go to a therapist or psychologist or counselor or coach, and you tell them that you sat with a tree and the tree felt like it opened your heart, and they look at you like they're trying to figure out what disorder to label you with. And I say that with a kind of like a fun love, because I'm not putting anybody down who does that work. It's really hard, arduous work to sit with people all day long and take in their trauma and diagnose them and give them medications and try to reduce harm in the world. And it's a lot. However, when you're kind of other than the norm, it can be really daunting and difficult and uncomfortable to sit with a psychologist. You're not going to feel maybe fully seen unless that psychologist has worked in animism. And Dr. Daniel Foer is a psychologist who has created a movement around animist psychology. And that is essentially understanding that there are more people in the world than just humans. Trees, insects, soil, gods and goddesses, ancestors, spirits, the earthly elements, the air. All these beings that surround us are people too. And when we start to understand that, we soon notice that we're not as alone as we feel like we are, because we have access to these amazing relationships, not resources to use, but living beings that are as complex and dynamic as us, who we get to actually come into communion with, connect, learn from, reciprocate, serve, and be served by. And that opens up an entirely different experience on this planet. And I find that it can be very healing for the mind and body when we open up to these animist, what do I want to call them, philosophies and values and practices. So I look forward to sharing this episode with you. And at the end, you'll have information for how to join one of his next offerings. So here's the episode with Dr. Daniel Foer. And I'd like to welcome Daniel Foer to the podcast. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I began taking your animist psychology course, and 7 classes in. And it's been so enlightening to discover language for what's been intuitive, right? For what I've felt and experienced, but didn't really have the words for, or knew there even was a lineage to describe that. So I wanted to ask you first to describe to me and everyone here, what is animism? What is animist psychology?
Yeah. Well, animism for me, as a way of talking about a set of core values, came through encountering the work of Graham Harvey, who's a British pagan scholar and is situated in an academic lineage of people like Irving Hollowell, who has a debt of gratitude to the Anishinaabe people, the Ojibwe people that he spent time with. But the term animism has been reclaimed and revitalized in academia in a way less colonialist way, in a way that includes respect for indigenous people, indigenous scholars themselves. And it's a way of referring to a set of values that basically says living humans are just one kind of person in a much wider field of kinship, community, other kinds of people. Those other kinds of people include the ancestors, the plants, the animals, deities, nature spirits, planets, you know, et cetera, you name it. And a lot of kinds of people that we don't have good language for in English. And there's a implicit ethic that says it's a good idea because you're in this community of kinship with these other kinds of people to relate in respectful and conscious ways, or at least intentional ways. And by virtue of saying these others are also people, which is probably the most efficient way to talk about it in English, that triggers the ethical, moral accountability that comes with interpersonal relationships. And so for me, that congealed a way of talking about things that allowed me to gently exit the language of shamanism. Respect to all that carried me in a good way for a while. And also paganism is more culturally specific to European ancestries, which are my own ancestries, early English, German, settler, colonialist lineages to North America. And so it was helpful to me about a decade or so ago to have the working language. I'm like, it's a more neutral language. I don't have to legitimize my love for the earth and the many beings by glomming on to indigenous cultures or indigeneity. It's just a set of core values that humans all over the place hold and have held to varying degrees. And then I happen to have a background in psychology. I'm a doctor of psychology. I'm a marriage and family therapist. So animist psychology is my attempt to hold that body of training and skills, which I respect, even though I also have critique of, and to harmonize that or blend that with what is even more central for me is being a ritualist and an animist orientation to ritual. And so what happens if psychology actually, not in a religious or spiritual way, but in a just core values way, cuts it out with the human supremacy and actually comes into a more relational stance and stops with the view that the colonialist view that respecting the other people is some kind of spiritual religious stance rather than a more objective and scientific way of moving in the world.
I think that's what really reached me because, you know, I'm a somatic therapist and I studied somatic psychologies and particularly the last 4 years really entrenched myself into somatic experiencing. And the, you know, the term co-regulation, so many times when I was co-regulating with other people, I was noticing, well, this is how I felt with the tree. You know, this is how I felt with an insect. This is how I felt with the wind. And none of my teachers had any kind of framework for that when I'd bring it up.
Right.
And so that was something I was really getting from your course. And I want to know more about your personal experience around co-regulating with everything as a being.
Yeah. Let me speak to one different thing before diving in with that. In some ways, from what you're reporting of your experience is like who the course is aimed at, because I want people who have the clinical training to understand that omitting the personhood or the reality of the other than humans is not just like, we overlooked an important resource. It's as fundamentally problematic as racism or sexism or classism or whatever kind of harm you might be, you know, experiencing in the moment or thinking about. And the correcting of that omission is important. And it's not about religion. It's about basic core values. And so I want to, because what happens is that this kind of inquiry gets stuck in the secular versus religious binary. And that is a losing discussion. It's a very like Protestant frame or anti-Protestant frame. And so it's, just flagging that on an intellectual level of how to mainstream animist values, which are really just good ethics and relational values. From my own journey, I grew up in Northern Ohio, in like white, suburban, kind of culturally blown out amnesia Bill, you know, and my childhood wasn't traumatic or terrible, and it was lonely in a lot of ways, like culturally lonely, I guess, or undernourished. And so what happened for me, I didn't piece it together really till later, but when I started to connect with ritual arts and shamanic practice and stuff like that, even when I was a teenager, which was fortunate, it gave me a framework. I gradually started to realize that the other than humans had been holding me and a source of co-regulation, if you will, through, you know, my childhood before I had any language for it. And I would spend a lot of time in the woods. I had the privilege of living close to the other than human neighborhoods, like the woods and the creek and the lake, Lake Erie. And so I look back and I'm like, this is a fundamental part of my own journey. That I was like psychically, psychologically, spiritually held together and damage was minimized from an otherwise under-nurturing environment through unconscious at the time relationship with the other than human community. And so later having a language to name that, I'm like, I bet I'm not the only one who has had that experience. Why are we not talking about it? This is problematic. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I just think it's so important because I think of the years, my early years when I went to therapy, you know, as the patient or client, and the conscious skirting around those experiences I would do because I didn't want to be labeled as like schizophrenic, you know, or bipolar or delusional or, you know, whatever would come through. So I find that this bridge that you're creating around this gap between animism and psychology is so important to reduce harm for people who have other than Eurocentric experiences and other than religious experiences. Yeah. Is that part of the intention or is that what you're seeing as a result?
Yeah, of course. I mean, generalizing to a large degree with at least the last 500 years of different forms of European colonialism, there's a really sort of emaciated or under nourishing, disconnected worldview that gets exported to a lot of the rest of the world through European colonialism. And I'm not generalizing about Europe. There's, you know, a whole bunch of different people doing lots of things. And I'm not even generalizing about all settler colonialists, but in general, there's a kind of whiteness or colonialist frame. And that informs also the field of psychology still, unfortunately, not completely, but still to a large degree. And so does helping clinicians or people in the field of psychology of whatever ancestry to at least be in a harm reduction mode, if not in a proactively animist, chilled out, great, let's talk to the tree, how was that for you kind of mode. Does that help them to be also more culturally proficient because people from other than European backgrounds are likely to have more recent cultural normalizing of these experiences? Yeah, for sure. And in some ways, the folks from other than European backgrounds may have been pressured to or chosen to distance from that larger kind of knowing in their own ancestries even more recently. And so there's a chance to address, not with an agenda, but be open to addressing what's been lost. And it's sometimes only a generation, or it's only like people got the teachings when they were a kid, but they haven't valued them, for example. And in that way, psychology was terrible like decades ago about queerness and trans everything, and now is like trending toward helpful. And depending on where you're at and your psychologist, whatever, psychology could be in a position to be proactively helpful in normalizing our innate human ability to relate with many other kinds of people, of many kinds of bodies, human and otherwise. And some clinicians are doing that, but not too many. Mm-hmm. And it does often enough tend to play out along sort of racialized lines in that way. And some of that's problematically racist and stereotypical. Like if there's a white clinician, it's like, oh, it's a Native American person. Of course, they're spiritual. It's like, wow, well, come on. That's a kind of tokenizing, asking someone who's native to hold one's own displaced indigeneity. Like I'm a cisgendered American privileged white guy, and I talk to the dead and the trees and all that. And so what category am I in? Like in that way, it is important that it be seen as a fundamental human capacity and longing even to be in relationship with the rest of life. But yeah, good clinicians are in a position to be culturally corrective around all that, for sure.
I think when you're using that word,
just healers of any sort, it doesn't have to be a psychology person, yeah.
Right, anyone really holding safe space for someone.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like the piece I'm hearing, the undercurrent of everything you're saying is it really comes down to relation. And it really comes down to curiosity around relation. Like,
yeah,
what is this relationship to you? How does it benefit you? How does it feel? Versus which are real, which aren't. It's kind of, well, how does it impact you? So if you're with a client and you're hearing that they're having this really profound kind of healing embodied relationship with a rock, that's useful for you. How do you, where do you go with that?
You enter it, of course. And like the starting premise is that these other kinds of people can be as important, not only for as a source of earned attachment or an emotionally corrective experience or an opportunity for co-regulation or a good feeling for the nervous system. Sure, that's like the in the moment benefit. but also good for helping the client to remember on a soul level what they're here to do, to remember their destiny, to remember themselves, to feel seen in a really deep way that allows someone to settle into their incarnation on earth. It's good because it breaks down harmful cultural conditioning that says only certain living humans are fully real. And so one becomes, it's a decolonizing act in that way, like culturally at least. It's not like repatriation of land, but it's part of the larger working. And then it's also a way of chipping at the extreme individualism that therapy can often unintentionally recreate. It's like, here are my problems. I'm going to come pay you to help me with my problems. Well, if we address the colonialism and the sexism and the racism and the classism and the bigotry and supremacy, what problems do you have left? What if all of your problems are systemic? And then maybe you have like this moody thing that you do, which maybe is more personal. But so in that way, therapy risks constructing things as too individualistic. And once you start relating with the stones and the dead and the woodpeckers and everything, then the way that you treat someone's suffering might not necessarily be, let me help you to suffer more. It might be like, let me help you to understand how you're useful to the stones. It's not about how can these relationships benefit you. It's like, maybe you need to grow some self-esteem by understanding that you can be of useful service to life. And until you enact your useful service to life, you're going to feel like garbage about yourself. So, and then not to go extreme to that and say, okay, you have to be useful or justify yourself, but there's a way in which centering our own pain can become part of the problem. Like, we need to be honest about our emotional experience, but then how we get unstuck from the ways that those things get stuck sometimes is about shifting focus to the other and the bigger, net that we're a part of.
I think it's a beautiful difference between using and relating, isn't it? Because if I'm like using the crystal versus relating to the crystal, the relating is where the reciprocity comes in. You know, what does it need in response? What is it saying to me? What is its name, right? How do I show up to it versus it's here for me? I find that when I think back to my early childhood experiences, I grew up in a very racist, sexist town in a mixed family, Puerto Rican on one side, Irish on another. And I'm intersex. So I grew up with breasts and hips, and I was totally visually different than the other boys. So I had this experience of being so not fitting into a certain human category. But I fit into so many of the deities, and I fit into so many of the trees and the rocks and the animals and the reverse gender roles and birds and nature. So I really kind of like, for survival as a young child, looked to nature for something to reflect me, because my society wasn't reflecting me at the time. Mm-hmm. When you were saying about that isolation, it really did change, because the collective was now the other than human world. And that's all I actually needed to feel safe. It got me through suicide. So yeah. I think it's such an important point about isolation. And when you go beyond the human world, there's actually so much to connect to.
One of the things I didn't get in my clinical training, and I went to progressive schools, so I should have gotten it, is the ability to really see someone well and on a like soul level, and the importance of essentially cultivating wisdom over a lifetime as a priority. And one of the key components of that, as I understand it at least, is cultivating a real diverse vocabulary for the sacred and for sacred difference. And animism as a value set tends to foreground that, tends to prioritize it. When people look to the other than human world, the thing that we problematically call nature, like the rest of the community of people, and prioritizes those relationships in a pragmatic way, it's the source of our existence, then there's a tendency to recognize there's all these different forms. My God, there's so many different plants and animals and beings and powers. how could they not be reflected in human community and internally in any given human? And so we are a cacophony, a multitude of all these different patterns and forms and diversities. Therefore, not always, but often that can encourage a greater empathy or appreciation, celebration of difference, because you wouldn't expect all of the other than human world to look the same. And so that's contrasted with what we could think of as like archetypal deficiency disorder, or like we're in at least modern Western culture, to generalize, we're dealing with like six crayons instead of 64. And so there's just not a vocabulary to see people, because we haven't necessarily recognized all those different voices and consciousnesses within ourselves. So how are we going to see it in other people? And if we can't see other people, we can't really see them on a soul level, we're not going to be as useful to them. And there's going to be something that doesn't quite click. And that's so, yeah, making a study of the different forms and patterns and expressions of the sacred is important if you're going to be in a healing capacity, because you'd be more able to see people accurately. Yeah.
So that brings me to, I don't know why it brings me here, but it makes me think about once. So if I think about, again, those early years, you know, Wicca and paganism were my first guiding, you know, blocks, right? Essentially. They were like one of the crayons that I had, the new crayons.
Same, yeah. You know, go witchcraft.
Yeah. And it was so enlightening, and it was so settling. And it gave me what you were talking about. There was this diversity, and there was this new language that, oh, that's not nature. I'm nature too. So that's me. And then there was this, again, this reciprocity. And I've found that those early years, like an early decade of exploring that and living that as a witch for so long, gave me the language to then connect better with Indigenous peoples, because we already had this framework. I never claimed indigeneity, but there was this language that was the same, because it really came down to relation and reciprocity with all, right? It's like the foundational value as I've seen it.
Right.
So I say this because I get so curious. I know you've done a lot of work with different Indigenous communities around the world. Well, I'm curious your guidance, I'll say, on how does someone in America who is not Indigenous to America, accessing their own, let's say, Indigenous roots, right? So they're not Indigenous, but they're Indigenous roots through their ancestors, their lineage. And then using that information to then, as I think one of your titles of one of your courses were become a place, almost like become the environment they're in, even though it's not their ancestors' land. It's a very heated topic, and I understand why. I want to know some clarity you might have around that.
Well, it's a big question, but to speak in the United States, there are people, of course, who arrive here through all different kinds of circumstances. There's, of course, Indigenous peoples, and then settler colonialists, people who are enslaved, people who come as immigrants under really harsh conditions, even recently. And so there's not one narrative only. But as a general approach, what I guide others through is what has served me, which is to get to know my own ancestors, including the ones who lived before the disruptions of colonialism, whether that's European or whether it's Roman colonialism in the second century in Germania or wherever. You know, so it might be way back, but in spirit time, it's all kind of in the present until it's been addressed. And so get to know what caused things to be messed up. Like, how did I become a not Indigenous person? In the bigger spiritual sense. Of course, I know indigeneity has more legal, political, specific thing. I'm not an Indigenous person, but if we use it in the broader sense of being like an earth honoring, connected to a place, not being a troll to my neighbors kind of person, like when did that stop in my lineages? So getting to know the people a generation before that and calling in their help to clean things up. So there's a cycle of ancestral reckoning and cleanup, which I recommend to people who could use it, which is a lot of people at this time in history. And then they become part of the essential internal guidance system. And it's also possible then with them to come to the land where you're at, including the human ancestors of that place, and say, hi, it's me and my people. This is how we got here. We want to be here in the most conscious way possible. What's that look like? And if you're not living in a place where your blood ancestors have been for a while, then you open a dialogue and you understand what are offerings that can be made. If there are living representatives of those communities who are actually open to being approached, doesn't tend to be the norm, but if that's an option, do that. Of course, be a good ally, do the right things in that vein. But on a like belonging spiritual level, humans don't own the land. Even humans that have been in a place for so many generations, there's absolutely a seniority and a respect for sacred spaces and a respect for, you know, territory that should be honored. But anyone with good sense wouldn't say, like, I own the earth, it's mine. And so in that way, we can approach a fire that's been cooking for a while and be like, can I come around the fire? What does that look like? How do I do it in a good way? So that can look like introducing your own ancestors to the forces who are already present, which tends to be a more trustworthy introduction. If somebody sends you a friend request on social media, you don't have anybody in common, you're like, what is this? But if you have 800 people in common, it's like, well, you're probably not crazy. I don't know. And so if you come with your ancestors and you're already in relationship with the river and the mountains and the land there, then you're probably going to have a more comfortable seat at the fire with the human dead who also speak through the land. So that helps, but it takes time and you have to prioritize it. When I lived in California, in the Bay Area, I prioritized it. I didn't have kids. I was less busy. And I spent a lot of time in the mountains and did a lot of ritual and a decade of ritual with the land. And then when I moved to North Carolina, it was jarring. Because I was moving out of this matrix of kind of belonging and connectedness that had gradually emerged from just spending quality time over the years with the spirits of place. But it's a big, gnarly kind of wound, the belonging thing. And how do we actually be owned by or become, get claimed by a place? And some people don't ever have it like that because even traditionally, some people move around. Like there's, you know, seasonal stuff, but also people who move around like a lot. But a final thing maybe is, at least in the United States, there's a lot of folks, because of the difficult histories, consensual, non-consensual arrival here and all the loss that goes along with that, who really don't have that aspect of belonging very much. And so I think in that vacuum, a lot of real, like, identitarian, overly personalized, identity-based stuff that is sometimes good, but often really divisive and reinforcing of trouble can happen. Because people will wear dirty clothes that are scratchy and don't fit them over being naked most of the time. So there's a sense of, I'll take whatever identity is on the menu, like over, I don't know who I am, because that was really distressing. Yeah.
I think what the part you said there, and you said it in one of the classes, was humans don't own the land. And the example you had used is when we say, like, for instance, I live in Woodstock, New York, you know, previously the territory of the Esopus people, right? Mm-hmm. I love this awareness. First of all, there's a respect there, and there's like a certain amount of politicism there, and I can respect that for what we're trying to heal by working with the shadow of the founding of our country. So that's important. And it's equally important when you said don't freeze the land or the earth in one time capsule, because it's like I had this woman on my podcast named Claudia, who's indigenous to Mexico. And she was saying that when you move to a new place, a new land that you're not from, whether you generationally found yourself there through settler colonialism or you immigrated there first generation, that's your new relative. And if you're looking at your old relative because you think you're not allowed to connect to your new relative, it's actually disrespectful to a new relative. And I found that so enlightening and similar to what you're saying about not owning the land. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it is important to not freeze time in that way. Like if I say I live in, you know, Western North Carolina, which is traditional Cherokee lands, there's respect to living Cherokee people. And also at the time of European contact, there are also who are now Creek, Muscogee, other than Cherokee peoples here. And it's not clear how long Cherokee people have been here. There are different understandings of that. But certainly we could say this is a land that got really informed by the arrival of corn in 12, 1300s, and which shaped the culture here. And what about the cultures before that, before that, before that? So there are layers and layers and layers and layers of history, human history. And it's not just one way. Like, it's not just one way pretty much anywhere on earth. So yeah, there's that. I do think it's rude to not engage in some way. And I'm guilty of that. Like, I struggle to feel settled with the energetics of this nation because it's like, feels like a really overbearing teenager I'm like trapped in the mall with. And there's this like stuck, borderline-y, like aggressive confusion that isn't everybody. And yet it's part of the national energetic enough that it's tough to be with. So I fantasize about finding a way to move to Europe, for example. And does that cause me to feel less connected to the Swannanoa River and the stones and the black bears and the praying mantises here in our area? Yeah, probably some days, because I'm in this other time and other place. And so there is an etiquette to, like any of the binaries we're being asked to disrupt, there's who we've been and there's who we are now. And it's not that we choose one over the other, but how do we bring all of what we are into the moment and see the powers that are unifying the earth that is beneath all of us and the stars and the, you know, the bigger frame that we're being held in. So it's important to spend time resting in what's unifying as well. And that, it's one of the core skills. I think a lot about parenting these days. We have a 7-month-old and a 3-year and 7-month-old. And how do we raise them with good values? Not just anti-supremacist values about other humans, but good animus values as well. And one of the key skills is being able to shift through different perspectives, being able to assume the perspective of the other, whether that's a stone or person of color or whatever it might be, like culturally different than you people in any way or, however. And so that means it's about not getting stuck in one story, I guess.
And, I agree.
Yeah.
So you're speaking to something important to me because I often feel like the experiment of America is needing this. It's needing animism because it's to have all these different people from different cultures and values and looks and beliefs, religions, what have you, sharing one big land. It's never been like this. It's so new, like so many different ones rubbing, fences, a fence to split your yard. And I find that so important because we aren't growing up in our school system or in our family systems or in our societal systems with the practices of how do I not flinch in response to the other. So yes. When you're saying this whole piece about animism, which is relating to the other and being curious about the other and kind of like empathizing and imagining what it's like to be the other, I find that to be the necessary practice for America to survive in a kind way.
Yeah. A prayer I would have for this nation or for the collective here, at least, would be to get really much more comfortable with conflict and more resilient to tolerate just the discomfort that is needed if we're to engage in a really authentic process of reckoning with the history. And I had the pleasure to teach 2 years ago now in Europe in a number of different places. And one of the more satisfying ancestral healing intensives was in Berlin. And there was maybe a quarter of the folks in the group are Jewish and from genuinely different ancestries. And to share in that vessel of where the historical, even the recent layers especially, but also before that of harm, were represented by the faces and lineages in the room. And to be able to come together around that and to hold one's own center, but also like tears and movement and like moving through stuff, was encouraging. And it just caused me to reflect on like what happens to the soul of a nation when they actually proactively choose to face what's difficult. I think Germany has been, not to idealize things, but exemplary in some ways by choosing to face like what the horrors of the Holocaust and what was unleashed. And so that's my dream for here is what if we did that? Because we really haven't as a collective body. Of course, some groups and some people do that their whole lives. It's not optional. But systemically, that's where the correction needs to happen. And the actual laws and policies and economics of things and the actual repatriation of land, etc. So if that could happen, it'd be so good. And it's it's just painful to see it be close, but not quite there.
I'm so with you. My heart's opening as you're saying it, because I think the practice of comfort with conflict and understanding through conflict and curiosity through conflict is so important.
Referencing Sarah Schulman's work of the conflict is not abuse, when the really important, and I'm supportive of it personally, dialogue around abolishing or reducing police became more foreground last year with the murder of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter movement. One of the things that seemed even more acute to me is we, in a way, and I say we generally here, but we create the police by not being very good at conflict. Like if we're going to call the police or the equivalent of the police, like in any given situation, call outside help because I can't regulate enough to actually be in a disagreement. Then that habit of saying, it's not that it's bad to co-regulate, but could we call our ancestors? Could we call our trusted elders? Could we call someone other than the cops to be the regulating force when there's a conflict? And so there are necessary capacity building skills to be able to divest from our need to call in those kinds of forces. And you know, and on a smaller level of scale, it's so common for people to have a projection onto someone or have an expectation. It doesn't get met quite right. Don't talk to them. Take it right to social media. Detonate. I'm like, well, that behavior creates the police. It's like the opposite of abolitionist ethics. Yeah.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think it's a great inquiry for people listening around, you know, how does my body regulate during conflict? Because conflict gets so overcoupled as threat. And so we have a hard time being with it. But this country, it's impossible not to have conflict with so many differing viewpoints.
And sure,
in nature, conflict so fertile. It thrives in conflict. And then we can too. You know, I want to say one more thing before I go to your course a bit. I want to ask you about, you said something before that I thought was important and helpful for a lot of people listening, how we can be really heavy and weighed down by America, and I'm doing quotes, which is essentially our social construct of the land.
Right.
And then there's the land. And to separate America from the land, I personally find to be so helpful, because you can be watching the news, you can be at a rally, you can be personally experiencing something systemic that's painful or harmful. And you go home and you put your feet on the ground and it's like nothing happened. And I'm curious what that's like for you.
It's like you said, I could probably stand to resource even more in the earth. There's a way in which when you're doing a thing and it becomes successful, it's easy to spend a lot of time at the computer, or it's easy to like get pulled into managing the success of a thing. So the combination of my practice going well with ancestral medicine and parenting two young children means I don't get to like bury myself in the earth that often. But one of the things I've been sitting with is how do we resource in the larger web of consciousness without even necessarily leaving the house all the time? And to not create the fiction that there's such a thing as nature. Yes, there are other than human forms. Yes, it's good to have a break from humans and human-shaped spaces. I'm not minimizing that contrast. There's a real contrast there. It's important, and it has to do with accessibility and class, and you know, all, there's a lot we could say about access to so-called nature. But the split itself, it can be really harmful. As soon as I say you ought to get out in nature more, you go from like, I didn't know I had a problem, to now I have a problem. Now I'm not resourced enough unless I get out more. And so it causes us to see everything that isn't feet in the stream as not nature, and to see ourselves as not nature. And once we do that, we've recreated our exile. And that, it's sad, like it's emotionally sad, but it's also sorry, child shouting from upstairs. It's also she's not troubled. She's got problems, but that's not one of them. Not enough raspberries, but and so when we create that kind of exile, moment to moment, in how we frame things, like the human nature split, we have to heal this human nature split. We have to stop talking about it in that way. Even trying to heal it is creating it. It also means we're less accountable when we're not part of a thing. You're like, well, that's nature. This is me. You could hurt that and I'm not hurt by it. Well, then you're not dropped in enough. It's one complicated body. Yeah.
I think that's so important. And I think back to the beginning of the interview when you were saying about going into a therapist's office and the individualism and let's heal the collective and then what's left to heal. And for me, that's what's left to heal. You know, the concepts we've adopted through our own conditioning and growing that mm-hmm. make us feel separate when we're not at all. You know, when I touch this desk of wood, I mean, I can feel it. It feels beautiful. It feels nice and settling. And it doesn't mean I'm less connected because I'm in an office with you through Skype, you know? Yeah. So I think it's a beautiful invitation. Yeah, I want to take a couple minutes to talk about your course, because
let me underscore one thing just by way of outro. I want to make sure that it's clear that I have a lot of respect for the people within the fields of mental health already doing excellent work. So it's not like hey, I got all the ideas, let me just devalue what's already happening. So there's a ton of people all around the world doing great work to interrupt and sort of decolonize, if you will, harmful patterns. And same with the traditions that we're referencing of earth-honoring animist traditions. A lot of folks didn't break their culture, or they kept it together under a lot of duress. And so for folks like myself and others who maybe listen and benefit, it's important to keep in mind that not everyone is in the same state or condition or needing the same thing. So it just feels important to temper it with that a little bit. But yeah,
I appreciate that. I think it's helpful. I want to know what people should know about your course. You know, what kind of people should take it? What do they plan to learn?
Yeah, sure. We have three big things coming up with the organization, with Ancestral Medicine. And there's a lot of information on the site. There's a lot of free resources. People can see what's up there. But the three big things, this in early July, we'll be opening a more fleshed out and awesome version of the Ancestral Lineage Healing online course, which is the one I've been guiding for a number of years. And we have a ton of supporters of different backgrounds, ancestries, life experiences. And so that's like a thorough way to dive into getting to know your ancestral lineages in a healing way. This experiential process. So that's opening soon. And a second totally new offering is Ancestor Circles, guided by people. We have at least 16 of them, guided by people of different backgrounds. So it's a small group of people who have a dedicated circle. It's ongoing for at least a quarter to dive into the ancestral healing in a different, more group-oriented way, which is great because there is a kind of co-regulation in being witnessed by one another in the process. Because a lot of what I teach about the ancestor work is in the book. You can get the book for $10, $15 and then read it, but it's different than being in a group of people going through a process. And the third thing is the practitioner training, and that'll be the fifth cohort or fifth time offering the training since 2016. And the application for that will be open in July or August. And that includes becoming, through the training, part of the Ancestral Medicine Practitioner Network. And there are currently, I think, about 45 people who have completed their certification in that work to guide ancestral healing services for others. And so I'm happy about that. I'm happy those services are available, I think, in 7 or 8 languages and people from different parts of the world, different backgrounds. So it brings me happiness to see the work grow and be enriched by different people's styles and calling with it. So
that's beautiful. I definitely encourage everyone listening to check out the website. And if they feel inspired, the courses are so affordable and they come through in really digestible bites, and they're so nice to listen to. They're very soothing. They're not overly sensational or thrilling in a way that dysregulates me. They're not overwhelming. They're really lovely. And I just love the work that you're doing. I in my mind, when you're talking about these 45 practitioners, I'm just seeing these nice seeds blowing and growing in different places around the world to heal some of this land trauma we've accrued. And ancestral trauma. I really appreciate that.
Great. Thanks. It's a delight most days. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on. It was really nice to speak with you.
Thanks, Luis. Yeah.
For more information on Dr. Daniel Foer's work, including his online courses, you can visit ancestralmedicine.org. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice. What's your body doing right now? Sit with it. Let it speak to you. And let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen. For all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.